Regent and Princess Rhaenyra was passed on to their sons, and the Queen's three boys, the princes Aegon, Aemond, and Daeron, grew to be bitter rivals of their Valyrian nephews, resentful of them for having stolen what they regarded as their birthright, the Iron Throne itself. Though all six boys attended the same feasts, balls, and revels, and sometimes trained together in the yard under the same master-at-arms and studied under the same maesters, this enforced closeness only served to feed their mutual mislike, rather than binding them together as brothers. Whilst Princess Rhaenyra misliked her stepmother Queen Alicent, she became fond and more than fond of her good sister Lady Lena. With Driftmark and Dragonstone so close, Daemon and Lena oft visited with the princess and her with them. Many a time they flew together on their dragons, and the princess's she-dragon, Syrax, produced several clutches of eggs. In 118 AC, with the blessing of King Viserys, Rhaenyra announced the betrothal of her two eldest sons to the daughters of Prince Daemon and Lady Lena. Jaqeris was 4 and Lucerys 3, the girls 2. And in 119 AC, when Lena found she was with child again, Rhaenyra flew to Driftmark to attend her during the birth. And so it was that the princess was at her good sister's side on the third day of that accursed year, 120 AC, the year of the Red Spring. A day and a night of labour left Lena Valerian pale and weak, but finally she gave birth to the son Prince Daemon had so long desired. But the babe was twisted and malformed and died within the hour. Nor did his mother long survive him. Her grueling labour had drained all of Lady Lena's strength, and grief weakened her still further, making her helpless before the onset of childbed fever. As her condition steadily worsened, despite the best efforts of Driftmark's young maester, Prince Daemon flew to Dragonstone and brought back Princess Rhaenyra's own maester, an older and more experienced man renowned for his skills as a healer. Sadly, Maester Girardis came too late. After 3 days of delirium, Lady Lena passed from this mortal coil. She was but 27. During her final hour, it is said, Lady Lena rose from her bed, pushed away the scepters praying over her, and made her way from her room intent on reaching Vega, that she might fly one last time before she died. Her strength failed her on the tower steps, however, and it was there she collapsed and died. Her husband, Prince Daemon, carried her back to her bed. Afterward, Mushroom tells us, Princess Rhaenyra sat vigil with him over Lady Lena's corpse, and comforted him in his grief. Lady Lena's death was the first tragedy of 120 AC, but it would not be the last. For this was to be a year when many of the long-simmering tensions and jealousies that had plagued the Seven Kingdoms finally came to a boil. A year when many and more would have reason to wail and grieve and rend their garments. Though none more than the Sea Snake, Lord Corlys Valerian, and his noble wife, Princess Rhaenys, she who might have been a queen. The Lord of the Tides and his lady were still in mourning for their beloved daughter, when the stranger came again to carry off their son. Sir Laenor Valerian, husband to the Princess Rhaenyra, and the putative father of her children, was slain whilst attending a fair in Spicetown, stabbed to death by his friend and companion, Sir Carl Corey. The two men had been quarrelling loudly before blades were drawn, merchants at the fair told Lord Valerian when he came to collect his son's body. Corey had fled by then, wounding several men who tried to hinder him. Some claimed a ship had been waiting for him offshore. He was never seen again. The circumstances of the murder remain a mystery to this day. Grand Maester Melos writes only that Selena was killed by one of his own household knights after a quarrel. Septon Eustace provides us with the killer's name, and declares jealousy the motive for the slaying. Lenor Valerian had grown weary of Sir Carl's companionship, and had grown enamoured of a new favourite, a handsome young squire of 6 and 10. Mushroom, as always, favours the most sinister theory, suggesting that Prince Daemon paid Carl Corey to dispose of Princess Rhaenyra's husband, arranged for a ship to carry him away, then cut his throat and fed him to the sea. A household knight of relatively low birth, Corrie was known to have a lord's tastes and a peasant's purse, and was given to extravagant wagering besides, which lends a certain credence to the fool's version of events. Yet there was no shred of proof, then or now, though the sea snake offered a reward of 10,000 golden dragons for any man who could lead him to Serkal Corrie, or deliver the killer to a father's vengeance. Even this was not the end of the tragedies that would mark that dreadful year. The next occurred at high tide after Serlena's funeral, when king and court made the journey to Driftmark to bear witness at his pyre, many on the backs of their dragons. So many dragons were present that Septon Eustace wrote that Driftmark had become the new Valyria. The cruelty of children is known to all. Prince Aegon Targaryen was 13, Princess Helena 11, Prince Aemond 10, and Prince Daeron 6. Both Aegon and Helena were dragon riders. Helena now flew Dreamfire, the she-dragon who had once carried Rhaenyra, Maegor the Cruel's Black Bride, whilst her brother Aegon's young Sunfire was said to be the most beautiful dragon ever seen upon the earth. Even Prince Daeron had a dragon, a lovely blue she-dragon named Tessarion, though he had yet to ride. Only the middle son, Prince Aemond, remained dragonless, but his grace had hopes of rectifying that and had put forward the notion that perhaps the court might sojourn at Dragonstone after the funeral. A wealth of dragons' eggs could be found beneath the Dragonmont, and several young hatchlings as well. Prince Aemond could have his choice, if the lad is bold enough. Even at 10, Aemond Targaryen did not lack for boldness. The king's gibe stung, and he resolved not to wait for Dragonstone. What did he want with some puny hatchling or some stupid egg? Right there at high tide was a dragon worthy of him. Vhagar, the oldest, largest, most terrible dragon in the world. Even for a son of House Targaryen, there are always dangers in approaching a dragon, particularly an old, bad-tempered dragon who has recently lost her rider. His father and mother would never allow him to go near Vhagar, Aemond knew, much less try to ride her, so he made certain they did not know. Sliding from his bed at dawn whilst they still slept, and stealing down to the outer yard where Vhagar and the other dragons were fed and stabled. The prince had hoped to mount Vhagar in secrecy, but as he crept up to the dragon, a boy's voice rang out. "You stay away from her!" The voice belonged to the youngest of his half-nephews, Joffrey Valerian, a boy of 3. Always an early riser, Joff had sneaked down from his bed to see his own young dragon, Tyraxes. Afraid that the boy would raise the alarm, Prince Aemond shouted at him to be quiet, then shoved him backward into a pile of dragon droppings. As Joff began to bawl, Aemond raced to Vhagar and clambered up onto her back. Later he would say that he was so afraid of being caught that he forgot to be frightened of being burned to death and eaten. Call it boldness, call it madness, call it fortune or the will of the gods or the caprice of dragons. Who can know the mind of such a beast? We do know this. Vhagar roared, lurched to her feet, shook violently, then snapped her chains and flew. And the boy prince, Aemond Targaryen, became a dragon rider, circling twice around the towers of high tide before coming down again. But when he landed, Rhaenyra's sons were waiting for him. Joffrey had run to get his brothers when Aemond took to the sky, and both Jace and Luke had come to his call. The Valyrian princelings were younger than Aemond. Jace was 6, Luke 5, Joff only 3. But there were 3 of them, and they had armed themselves with wooden swords from the training yard. Now they fell on him with a fury. Aemond fought back, breaking Luke's nose with a punch, then wrenching the sword from Joff's hands and cracking it across the back of Jace's head, driving him to his knees. As the younger boys scrambled back away from him, bloody and bruised, the prince began to mock them, laughing and calling them the Strongs. Jace, at least, was old enough to grasp the insult. He flew at Aemond once again, but the older boy began pummeling him savagely until Luke, coming to the rescue of his brother, drew his dagger and slashed Aemond across the face, taking out his right eye. By the time the stable boys finally arrived to pull apart the combatants, the prince was writhing on the ground, howling in pain, and Vhagar was roaring as well. Afterward, King Viserys tried to make a peace, requiring each of the boys to tender an apology to his rivals on the other side, but these courtesies did not appease their vengeful mothers. Queen Alicent demanded that one of Lucerys Valerian's eyes should be put out for the eye he had cost Aemond. Princess Rhaenyra would have none of that, but insisted that Prince Aemond should be questioned sharply until he revealed where he had heard her sons called Strongs. To so name them was tantamount to saying they were bastards, with no rights of succession, and that she herself was guilty of high treason. When pressed by the king, Prince Aemond said it was his brother Aegon who had told him they were Strongs, and Prince Aegon said only, "Everyone knows. Just look at them." King Viserys finally put an end to the questioning, declaring he would hear no more. No eyes would be put out, he decreed. But should anyone, man or woman or child, noble or common or royal, mock his grandsons as Strongs again, their tongues would be pulled out with hot pincers. His Grace further commanded his wife and daughter to kiss and exchange vows of love and affection. But their false smiles and empty words deceived no one but the king. As for the boys, Prince Aemond said later that he lost an eye and gained a dragon that day, and counted it a fair exchange. To prevent further conflict and put an end to these vile rumours and base calumnies, King Viserys further decreed that Queen Alicent and her sons would return with him to court, whilst Princess Rhaenyra confined herself to Dragonstone with her sons. Henceforth, Sir Eric Cargill of the King's Guard would serve as her sworn shield, whilst Breakbones returned to Harrenhal. "These rulings pleased no one," Septon Eustace writes. Mushroom demurs. One man at least was thrilled by the decrees, for Dragonstone and Driftmark lay quite close to one another, and this proximity would allow Daemon Targaryen ample opportunity to comfort his niece, Princess Rhaenyra, unbeknownst to the king. Though Viserys I would reign for 9 more years, the bloody seeds of the Dance of the Dragons had already been planted, and 120 AC was the year when they began to sprout. The next to perish were the Elder Strongs. Lionel Strong, Lord of Harrenhal and Hand of the King, accompanied his son and heir, Sir Harwin, on his return to the great half-ruined castle on the lakeshore. Shortly after their arrival, a fire broke out in the tower where they were sleeping, and both father and son were killed, along with 3 of their retainers and 12 servants. The cause of the fire was never determined. Some put it down to simple mischance, whilst others muttered that Black Harren's seat was cursed and brought only doom to any man who held it. Many suspected the blaze was set intentionally. Mushroom suggests that the sea snake was behind it as an act of vengeance against the man who had cuckolded his son. Septon Eustace, more plausibly, suspects Prince Daemon, removing a rival for Princess Rhaenyra's affections. Others have put forth the notion that Larys Clubfoot might have been responsible. With his father and elder brother dead, Larys Strong became the Lord of Harrenhal. The most disturbing possibility was advanced by none other than Grand Maester Mellos, who muses that the king himself might have given the command. If Viserys had come to accept that the rumours about the parentage of Rhaenyra's children were true, he might well have wished to remove the man who had dishonoured his daughter, lest he somehow reveal the bastardy of her sons. Were that so, Lionel Strong's death was an unfortunate accident, for his lordship's decision to see his son back to Harrenhal had been unforeseen. Lord Strong had been the king's hand, and Viserys had come to rely upon his strength and counsel. His Grace had reached the age of 43 and had grown quite stout. He no longer had a young man's vigour and was afflicted by gout, aching joints, back pain, and a tightness in the chest that came and went, and oft left him red-faced and short of breath. The governance of the realm was a daunting task. The king needed a strong, capable hand to shoulder some of his burdens. Briefly, he considered sending for Princess Rhaenyra. Who better to rule with him than the daughter he meant to succeed him on the Iron Throne? But that would have meant bringing the princess and her sons back to King's Landing, where more conflict with the queen and her own brood would have been inevitable. He considered his brother as well, until he recalled Prince Daemon's previous stints on the small council. Grand Maester Melos suggested bringing in some younger man and put forward several names, but his grace chose familiarity, and recalled to court Ser Otto Hightower, the queen's father, who had filled the office before for both Viserys and the old king. Yet hardly had Ser Otto arrived at the Red Keep to take up the handship than word reached court that Princess Rhaenyra had remarried, taking to husband her uncle, Daemon Targaryen. The princess was 23, Prince Daemon 39. King, court, and commons were all outraged by the news. Neither Daemon's wife nor Rhaenyra's husband had been dead even half a year. To wed again so soon was an insult to their memories, his grace declared angrily. The marriage had been performed on Dragonstone, suddenly and secretly. Septon Eustace claims that Rhaenyra knew her father would never approve of the match, so she wed in haste to make certain he could not prevent the marriage. Mushroom puts forward a different reason. The princess was once again with child and did not wish to birth a bastard. And thus, that dreadful year 120 AC ended as it began, with a woman labouring in childbirth. Princess Rhaenyra's pregnancy had a happier outcome than Lady Lena's had. As the year waned, she brought forth a small but robust son, a pale princeling with dark purple eyes and pale silvery hair. She named him Aegon. Prince Daemon had at last a living son of his own blood, and this new prince, unlike his three half-brothers, was plainly a Targaryen. In King's Landing, however, Queen Alicent grew most wroth when she learned the babe had been named Aegon, taking that for a slight against her own son Aegon, which, according to the testimony of Mushroom, it most certainly was. Hereafter, to avoid confusing the two princes, we will refer to Queen Alicent's son as Aegon the Elder, and Princess Rhaenyra's son as Aegon the Younger. By all rights, the year 122 AC should have been a joyous one for House Targaryen. Princess Rhaenyra took to the birthing bed once more and gave her uncle Daemon a second son, named Viserys after his grandsire. The child was smaller and less robust than his brother Aegon and his Valyrian half-brothers, but proved to be a most precocious child, though somewhat ominously the dragon's egg, placed in his cradle, never hatched. The Greens took that for an ill omen, and were not shy about saying as much. Later that same year, King's Landing celebrated a wedding as well. Following the ancient tradition of House Targaryen, King Viserys wed his son, Aegon the Elder, to his daughter Helena. The groom was 15 years of age, a lazy and somewhat sulky boy, Septon Eustace tells us, but possessed of more than healthy appetites, a glutton at table, given to swilling ale and strong wine, and pinching and fondling any serving girl who strayed within his reach. The bride, his sister, was but 13. Though plumper and less striking than most Targaryens, Helena was a pleasant, happy girl, and all agreed she would make a fine mother. And so she did, and quickly. Barely a year later, in 123 AC, the 14-year-old princess gave birth to twins, a boy she named Jaehaerys and a girl named Jaehaera. Prince Aegon had heirs of his own now, the Greens at court proclaimed happily. A dragon's egg was placed in the cradle of each child, and two hatchlings soon came forth. Yet all was not well with these new twins. Jaehaera was tiny and slow to grow. She did not cry, she did not smile, she did none of the things a babe was meant to do. Her brother, whilst larger and more robust, was also less perfect than was expected of a Targaryen princeling, boasting 6 fingers on his left hand and 6 toes upon each foot. A wife and children did little to curb the carnal appetites of Prince Aegon the Elder. If Mushroom is to be believed, He fathered two bastard children the same year as the twins, a boy on a girl whose maidenhood he won at auction on the Street of Silk, and a girl by one of his mother's maidservants. And in 127 AC, Princess Helena gave birth to his second son, who was given a dragon's egg and the name Melor. Queen Alicent's other sons had been growing older as well. Prince Aemond, despite the loss of his eye, had become a proficient and dangerous swordsman under the tutelage of Sir Criston Cole, but remained a wild and wilful child, hot-tempered and unforgiving. His little brother, Prince Darren, was the most popular of the Queen's sons, as clever as he was courteous and most comely as well. When he turned 12 in 126 AC, Darren was sent to Old Town to serve as cupbearer and squire to Lord Hightower. That same year, across Blackwater Bay, the sea snake was stricken by a sudden fever. As he took to his bed, surrounded by maesters, the issue arose as to who should succeed him as Lord of the Tides and Master of Driftmark, should the sickness claim him. With both his true-born children dead, by law his lands and titles should pass to his eldest grandson, Jaqeris. But since Jace would presumably ascend the Iron Throne after his mother, Princess Rhaenyra urged her good father to name instead her second son, Lucerys. Lord Corlys also had half a dozen nephews, however, and the eldest of them, Sir Vaemond Valerian, protested that the inheritance by rights should pass to him, on the grounds that Rhaenyra's sons were bastards sired by Harwin Strong. The princess was not slow in answering this charge. She dispatched Prince Daemon to seize Sir Vaemond, had his head removed and fed his carcass to her dragon, Syrax. Even this did not end the matter, however. Sir Vaemond's younger cousins fled to King's Landing with his wife and sons, there to cry for justice and place their claims before the king and queen. King Viserys had grown extremely fat and red of face, and scarce had the strength to mount the steps to the Iron Throne. His Grace heard them out in a stony silence, then ordered their tongues removed, every one. "You were warned," he declared as they were being dragged away. "I will hear no more of these lies." Yet, as he was descending, his Grace stumbled and reached out to right himself, and sliced his left hand open to the bone on a jagged blade protruding from the throne. Though Grand Maester Millos washed the cut out with boiled wine, and bound up the hand with strips of linen soaked in healing ointments, fever soon followed, and many feared the king might die. Only the arrival of Princess Rhaenyra from Dragonstone turned the tide, for with her came her own healer, Maester Gerardus, who acted swiftly to remove two fingers from his Grace's hand to save his life. Though much weakened by his ordeal, King Viserys soon resumed the rule. To celebrate his recovery, a feast was held on the first day of 127 AC. The princess and the queen were both commanded to attend, with all their children. In a show of amity, each woman wore the other's colour, and many declarations of love were made, to the king's great pleasure. Prince Daemon raised a cup to Ser Otto Hightower and thanked him for his leal service as hand. Ser Otto, in turn, spoke of the prince's courage, whilst Alicent's children and Rhaenyra's greeted one another with kisses and broke bread together at table. Or so the court chronicles record. Yet late in the evening after King Viserys had departed, for his Grace still tired easily, Mushroom tells us that Aemond One-Eye rose to toast his Valerian nephews, speaking in mock admiration of their brown hair, brown eyes, and strength. "I have never known anyone so strong as my sweet nephews," he ended. "So let us drain our cups to these three strong boys." Still later, the fool reports, Aegon the Elder took offence when Jaqeris asked his wife Helena for a dance. Angry words were exchanged, and the two princes might have come to blows if not for the intervention of the king's guard. Whether King Viserys was ever informed of these incidents, we do not know, but Princess Rhaenyra and her sons returned to their own seat on Dragonstone the next morning. After the loss of his fingers, Viserys I never sat upon the Iron Throne again. Thereafter he shunned the throne room, preferring to hold court in his solar, and later in his bedchamber, surrounded by maesters, septons, and his faithful fool Mushroom, the only man who could still make him laugh, says Mushroom. Death visited the court again a short time later, when Grand Maester Melos collapsed one night whilst he was climbing the serpentine steps. His had always been a moderating voice in council, forever urging calm and compromise whenever issues arose between the blacks and the greens. To the king's distress, however, the passing of the man he called my trusted friend only served to provoke a fresh dispute between the factions. Princess Rhaenyra wanted Maester Gerardus, who had long served her on Dragonstone, elevated to replace Melos. It was only his healing skills that had saved the king's life when Viserys cut his hand on the throne, she claimed. Queen Alicent, however, insisted that the princess and her maester had mutilated his grace unnecessarily. Had they not meddled, she claimed, Grand Maester Melos would surely have saved the king's fingers as well as his life. She urged the appointment of one Maester Alphador, presently in service at the High Tower. Viserys, beset from both sides, chose neither, reminding both the princess and the queen that the choice was not his to make. The citadel of Old Town chose the Grand Maester, not the crown. In due time the conclave bestowed the chain of office upon Archmaester Orwell, one of their own. King Viserys did seem to recover some of his old vigour once the new Grand Maester arrived at court. Septon Eustace tells us that this was the result of prayer, but most believed that Orwell's potions and tinctures were more efficacious than the leechings Melos had preferred. But such recoveries proved short-lived, and gout, chest pains and shortness of breath continued to trouble the king. In the final years of his reign, as his health failed, Viserys left ever more of the governance of the realm to his hand and small council. Perforce we ought to look at the members of that small council on the eve of the great events of 129 AC, for they were to play a large role in all that followed. The king's hand remained Sir Otto Hightower, father of the queen and uncle to the Lord of Oldtown. Grand Maester Orwell was the newest member of the council, and was thought to favour neither blacks nor greens. The Lord Commander of the King's Guard remained Sir Criston Cole, however, and in him Rhaenyra had a bitter foe. The aged Lord Lyman Beesbury was Master of Coin, in which capacity he had served almost uninterrupted since the old king's day. The youngest councillors were the Lord Admiral and Master of Ships, Sir Tyland Lannister, brother to the Lord of Casterly Rock, and the Lord Confessor and Master of Whisperers, Larys Strong, Lord of Harrenhal. Lord Jasper Wilde, Master of Laws, known amongst the small folk as Iron Rod, completed the council. Lord Wilde's unbending attitudes on matters of law earned him this sobriquet, Septon Eustace says. But Mushroom declares that Iron Rod was named for the stiffness of his member, having sired 29 children on 4 wives before the last died of exhaustion. As the Seven Kingdoms welcomed the 129th year after Aegon's conquest with bonfires, feasts, and bacchanals, King Viserys I Targaryen was growing ever weaker. His chest pains had grown so severe that he could no longer climb a flight of steps, and had to be carried about the Red Keep in a chair. By the second moon of the year, his grace had lost all appetite, and was ruling the realm from his bed, when he felt strong enough to rule at all. Most days he preferred to leave matters of state to his hand, Sir Otto Hightower. On Dragonstone, meanwhile, Princess Rhaenyra was once again great with child. She, too, took to her bed. On the third day of the third moon of 129 AC, Princess Helena brought her 3 children to visit with the king in his chambers. The twins, Jaehaerys and Jaehaera, were 6 years old, their brother, Maelor, only 2. His grace gave the babe a pearl ring off his finger to play with, and told the twins the story of how their great-great-grandsire and namesake, Jaehaerys, had flown his dragon north to the wall to defeat a vast host of wildlings, giants, and wargs. Though the children had heard the story a dozen times before, they listened attentively. Afterward the king sent them away, pleading weariness and a tightness in his chest. Then Viserys of House Targaryen, the first of his name, King of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm, closed his eyes and went to sleep. He never woke. He was 52 years old and had reigned over most of Westeros for 26 years. Then the storm broke, and the dragons danced. The Dying of the Dragons, the Blacks and the Greens. The Dance of the Dragons is the fiery name bestowed upon the savage internecine struggle for the Iron Throne of Westeros, fought between two rival branches of House Targaryen during the years 129 to 131 AC. To characterize the dark, turbulent, bloody doings of this period as a dance strikes us as grotesquely inappropriate. No doubt the phrase originated with some singer. The Dying of the Dragons would be altogether more fitting, but tradition, time, and Grand Maester Munken have burned the more poetic usage into the pages of history. So we must dance along with the rest. There were two principal claimants to the Iron Throne upon the death of King Viserys I Targaryen, his daughter Rhaenyra, the only surviving child of his first marriage, and Aegon, his eldest son, by his second wife. Amidst the chaos and carnage brought on by their rivalry, other would-be kings would stake claims as well, strutting about like mummers on a stage for a fortnight or a moon's turn, only to fall as swiftly as they had arisen. The dance split the Seven Kingdoms in two, as lords, knights, and small folk declared for one side or the other, and took up arms against one another. Even House Targaryen itself was divided, when the kith, kin, and children of each of the claimants became embroiled in the fighting. Over the 2 years of struggle, a terrible toll was taken on the great lords of Westeros, together with their bannermen, knights, and small folk. Whilst the dynasty survived, the end of the fighting saw Targaryen power much diminished, and the world's last dragons vastly reduced in number. The dance was a war unlike any other ever fought in the long history of the Seven Kingdoms. Though armies marched and met in savage battle, much of the slaughter took place on water, and especially in the air, as dragon fought dragon with tooth and claw and flame. It was a war marked by stealth, murder, and betrayal as well, a war fought in shadows and stairwells, council chambers and castle yards, with knives and lies and poison. Long simmering, the conflict burst into the open on the third day of the third moon of 129 AC, when the ailing, bedridden King Viserys I Targaryen closed his eyes for a nap in the Red Keep of King's Landing and died without waking. His body was discovered by a serving man at the hour of the bat, when it was the king's custom to take a cup of hippocras. The servant ran to inform Queen Alicent, whose apartments were on the floor below the king's. Septon Eustace, writing on these events some years later, points out that the manservant delivered his dire tidings directly to the queen, and her alone, without raising a general alarm. Eustace does not believe this was wholly fortuitous. The king's death had been anticipated for some time, he argues, and Queen Alicent and her party, the so-called Greens, had taken care to instruct all of Viserys's guards and servants in what to do when the day came. The dwarf mushroom suggests a more sinister scenario, whereby Queen Alicent hurried King Viserys on his way with a pinch of poison in his hippocras. It must be noted that Mushroom was not in King's Landing the night the king died, but rather on Dragonstone, in service with Princess Rhaenyra. Queen Alicent went at once to the king's bedchamber, accompanied by Sir Criston Cole, Lord Commander of the King's Guard. Once they had confirmed that Viserys was dead, Her Grace ordered his room sealed and placed under guard. The serving man who had found the king's body was taken into custody, to make certain he did not spread the tale. Sir Criston returned to Whitesword Tower and sent his brothers of the king's guard to summon the members of the king's small council. It was the hour of the owl. Then, as now, the sworn brotherhood of the king's guard consisted of 7 knights, men of proven loyalty and undoubted prowess, who had taken solemn oaths to devote their lives to defending the king's person and kin. Only 5 of the White Cloaks were in King's Landing at the time of Viserys's death: Sir Criston himself, Sir Eric Cargill, Sir Rickard Thorne, Sir Stephen Darklyn, and Sir Willis Fell. Sir Eric Cargill, twin to Sir Eric, and Sir Lawrence Marbrand, with Princess Rhaenyra on Dragonstone, remained unaware and uninvolved as their brothers-in-arms went forth into the night to rouse the members of the small council from their beds. The council convened in the Queen's apartments within Maegor's Holdfast. Many accounts have come down to us of what was said and done that night. By far the most detailed and authoritative of them is Grand Maester Munkin's The Dance of the Dragons, A True Telling. Though Munkin's exhaustive history was not written until a generation later, and drew on many different sorts of materials, including Maester's chronicles, memoirs, steward's records, and interviews with 147 surviving witnesses to the great events of these times, his account of the inner workings of the court relies upon the confessions of Grand Maester Orwell, as set down before his execution. Unlike Mushroom and Septon Eustace, whose versions derive from rumours, hearsay, and family legend, the Grand Maester was present at the meeting, and took part in the council's deliberations and decisions, though it must be recognised that at the time he wrote, Orwell was most anxious to show himself in a favourable light, and absolve himself of any blame for what was to follow. Munkin's True Telling, therefore, paints his predecessor in perhaps too favourable a light. Gathering in the Queen's chambers as the body of her lord husband grew cold above, were Queen Alicent herself, her father, Sir Otto Hightower, Hand of the King, Sir Criston Cole, Lord Commander of the King's Guard, Grand Maester Orwell, Lord Lyman Beesbury, Master of Coin, a man of 80, Sir Tyland Lannister, Master of Ships, brother to the Lord of Casterly Rock, Larys Strong, called Larys Clubfoot, Lord of Harrenhal, Master of Whisperers, and Lord Jasper Wilde, called Ironrod, Master of Laws. Grand Maester Munkin dubs this gathering the Green Council in his True Telling. Grand Maester Orwell opened the meeting by reviewing the customary tasks and procedures required at the death of a king. He said, "Septon Eustace should be summoned to perform the last rites and pray for the king's soul. A raven must needs be sent to Dragonstone at once to inform Princess Rhaenyra of her father's passing. Mayhaps Her Grace the Queen would care to write the message so as to soften these sad tidings with some words of condolence. The bells are always rung to announce the death of a king. Someone should see to that. And, of course, we must begin to make our preparations for Queen Rhaenyra's coronation." Sir Otto Hightower cut him off. "All this must needs wait," he declared, "until the question of succession is settled." As the king's hand, he was empowered to speak with the king's voice, even to sit the Iron Throne in the king's absence. Viserys had granted him the authority to rule over the Seven Kingdoms, and until such time as our new king is crowned, that rule would continue. "Until our new queen is crowned," someone said. In Grand Maester Munkin's account, the words are Orwell's, spoken softly, no more than a quibble. But Mushroom and Septon Eustace insist it was Lord Beesbury who spoke up, and in a waspish tone. "King," insisted Queen Alicent, "the Iron Throne by rights must pass to His Grace's eldest true-born son." The discussion that followed lasted nigh unto dawn, Grand Maester Munkin tells us. Mushroom and Septon Eustace concur. In their accounts, only Lord Beesbury spoke on behalf of Princess Rhaenyra. The ancient Master of Coin, who had served King Viserys for the majority of his reign, and his grandfather Jaehaerys, the old king before him, reminded the council that Rhaenyra was older than her brothers, and had more Targaryen blood, that the late king had chosen her as his successor, that he had repeatedly refused to alter the succession despite the pleadings of Queen Alicent and her greens, that hundreds of lords and landed knights had done obeisance to the princess in 105 AC, and sworn solemn oaths to defend her rights. Grand Maester Orwell's account differs only in that he puts many of these arguments into his own mouth, rather than Beesbury's, but subsequent events suggest that was not so, as we shall see. But these words fell on ears made of stone. Sir Tyland pointed out that many of the lords who had sworn to defend the succession of Princess Rhaenyra were long dead. "It has been 24 years," he said. "I myself swore no such oath. I was a child at the time." Ironrod, the Master of Laws, cited the Great Council of 101, and the old king's choice of Balon rather than Rhaenys in 92, then discoursed at length about Aegon the Conqueror and his sisters, and the hallowed Andor tradition wherein the rights of a true-born son always came before the rights of a mere daughter. So Otto reminded them that Rhaenyra's husband was none other than Prince Daemon, and "we all know that one's nature. Make no mistake. Should Rhaenyra ever sit the Iron Throne, it will be Lord Fleabottom who rules us, a king consort as cruel and unforgiving as Maegor ever was. My own head will be the first cut off, I do not doubt, but your queen, my daughter, will soon follow." Queen Alicent echoed him. "Nor will they spare my children," she declared. "Aegon and his brothers are the king's true-born sons, with a better claim to the throne than her brood of bastards. Daemon will find some pretext to put them all to death, even Helena and her little ones. One of these strongs put out Aemon's eye, never forget. He was a boy, aye, but the boy is the father to the man, and bastards are monstrous by nature." Sir Criston Cole spoke up. "Should the princess reign," he reminded them, "Jacaerys Valerian would rule after her. Seven save this realm if we seat a bastard on the Iron Throne." He spoke of Rhaenyra's wanton ways, and the infamy of her husband. "They will turn the Red Keep into a brothel. No man's daughter will be safe, nor any man's wife. Even the boys. We know what Laenor was." It is not recorded that Lord Larys Strong spoke a word during this debate, but that was not unusual. Though glib of tongue when need be, the Master of Whisperers hoarded his words like a miser hoarding coins, preferring to listen rather than talk. "If we do this," Grand Maester Orwell cautioned the council, "according to the true telling, it must surely lead to war. The princess will not meekly stand aside, and she has dragons." "And friends," Lord Beesbury declared, "men of honour, who will not forget the vows they swore to her and her father. I am an old man, but not so old that I will sit here meekly whilst the likes of you plot to steal her crown." And so saying, he rose to go. As to what happened next, our sources differ. Grand Maester Orwell tells us that Lord Beesbury was seized at the door by the command of Ser Otto Hightower and escorted to the dungeons. Confined to a black cell, he would in time perish of a chill whilst awaiting trial. Septon Eustace tells it elsewise. In his account, Sir Criston Cole forced Lord Beesbury back into his seat and opened his throat with a dagger. Mushroom charges Sir Criston with his lordship's death as well, but in his version, Cole grasped the old man by the back of his collar and flung him out a window, to die impaled upon the iron spikes in the dry moat below. All three chronicles agree on one particular. The first blood shed in the Dance of the Dragons belonged to Lord Lyman Beesbury, Master of Coin and Lord Treasurer of the Seven Kingdoms. No further dissent was heard after the death of Lord Beesbury. The rest of the night was spent making plans for the new king's coronation. It must be done quickly, all agreed, and drawing up lists of possible allies and potential enemies, should Princess Rhaenyra refuse to accept King Aegon's ascension. With the princess in confinement on Dragonstone about to give birth, Queen Alicent's greens enjoyed an advantage. The longer Rhaenyra remained ignorant of the king's death, the slower she would be to move. "Mayhaps the whore will die in childbirth," Queen Alicent is reported to have said, according to Mushroom. No ravens flew that night. No bells rang. Those servants who knew of the king's passing were sent to the dungeons. Sir Criston Cole was given the task of taking into custody such blacks as remained at court, those lords and knights who might be inclined to favour Princess Rhaenyra. "Do them no violence, unless they resist," Sir Otto Hightower commanded. "Such men as bend the knee and swear fealty to King Aegon shall suffer no harm at our hands." "And those who will not?" asked Grand Maester Orwell. "Are traitors," said Ironrod, "and must die a traitor's death." Lord Larys Strong, Master of Whisperers, then spoke for the first and only time. "Let us be the first to swear," he said, "lest there be traitors here amongst us." Drawing his dagger, the clubfoot drew it across his palm. "A blood oath," he urged, "to bind us all together, brothers unto death." And so each of the conspirators slashed their palms and clasped hands with one another, swearing brotherhood. Queen Alicent, alone amongst them, was excused from the oath on account of her womanhood. Dawn was breaking over the city before Queen Alicent dispatched the King's Guard to bring her sons Aegon and Aemond to the council. Prince Darren, the youngest and gentlest of her children, was in Oldtown, serving as Lord Hightower's squire. One-eyed Prince Aemond, 19, was found in the armoury, donning plate and mail for his morning practice in the castle yard. "Is Aegon king?" he asked Sir Willis Fell, "or must we kneel and kiss the old whore's canny?" Princess Helena was breaking her fast with her children when the King's Guard came to her, but when asked the whereabouts of Prince Aegon, her brother and husband, she said only, "He is not in my bed, you may be sure. Feel free to search beneath the blankets." Prince Aegon was at his revels, Monken says in his true telling, vaguely. The testimony of Mushroom claims Sir Criston found the young king to be drunk and naked in a flea-bottom rat-pit, where two gutter-snipes with filed teeth were biting and tearing at each other for his amusement, whilst a girl who could not have been more than 12 pleasured his member with her mouth. Let us put that ugly picture down to Mushroom being Mushroom, however, and consider instead the words of Septon Eustace. Though the good Septon admits Prince Aegon was with a paramour when he was found, he insists the girl was the daughter of a wealthy trader, and well cared for besides. Moreover, the prince at first refused to be a part of his mother's plans. "My sister is the heir, not me," he says in Eustace's account. "What sort of brother steals his sister's birthright?" Only when Sir Criston convinced him that the princess must surely execute him and his brothers should she don the crown, did Aegon waver. "Whilst any true-born Targaryen yet lives, no strong can ever hope to sit the Iron Throne," Cole said. "Rhaenyra has no choice but to take your heads if she wishes her bastards to rule after her." It was this, and only this, that persuaded Aegon to accept the crown that the small council was offering him, insists our gentle Septon. Whilst the knights of the King's Guard were seeking after Queen Alicent's sons, other messengers summoned the commander of the city watch and his captains, there were 7, each commanding one of the city gates, to the Red Keep. 5 were judged sympathetic to Prince Aegon's cause when questioned. The other 2, along with their commander, were deemed untrustworthy, and found themselves in chains. Sir Luther Largent, the most fearsome of the Leal 5, was made the new commander of the Gold Cloaks. A bull of a man, and nigh on 7 feet tall, Largent was rumoured to have once killed a war-horse with a single punch. Sir Otto being a prudent man, however, he took care to name his own son, Sir Gawain Hightower, the Queen's brother, as Largent's 2nd, instructing him to keep a wary eye on Sir Luther for any signs of disloyalty. Sir Tyland Lannister was named Master of Coin in place of the late Lord Beesbury, and acted at once to seize the royal treasury. The crown's gold was divided into 4 parts. 1 part was entrusted to the care of the Iron Bank of Braavos for safekeeping, another sent under strong guard to Casterly Rock, a 3rd to Oldtown. The remaining wealth was to be used for bribes and gifts, and to hire sellswords if needed. To take Sir Tyland's place as master of ships, Sir Otto looked to the Iron Islands, dispatching a raven to Dalton Greyjoy, the Red Kraken, the daring and bloodthirsty 16-year-old Lord Reaper of Pike, offering him the Admiralty and a seat on the council for his allegiance. A day passed. Then another. Neither Septons nor Silent Sisters were summoned to the bedchamber where King Viserys lay, swollen and rotting. No bells rang. Ravens flew, but not to Dragonstone. They went instead to Oldtown, to Casterly Rock, to River Run, to Highgarden, and to many other lords and knights whom Queen Alicent had cause to think might be sympathetic to her son. The annals of the Great Council of 101 were brought forth and examined, and note was made of which lords had spoken for Viserys and which for Rhaenys, Laena, or Laenor. The lords assembled had favoured the male claimant over the female by 20-1, but there had been dissenters, and those same houses were most like to lend Princess Rhaenyra their support should it come to war. The princess would have the Sea Snake and his fleets, Sir Otto judged, and like as not the other lords of the eastern shores as well, lords Bar Emon, Massey, Celtigar, and Crab, most like, perhaps even the Even Star of Tarth. All were lesser powers, save for the Valerians. The Northmen were a greater concern, Winterfell had spoken for Rhaenys at Harrenhal, as had Lord Stark's bannermen Dustin of Barrowton and Manderly of White Harbour. Nor could House Arryn be relied upon, for the Eyrie was presently ruled by a woman, Lady Jane, the Maiden of the Vale, whose own rights might be called into question should Princess Rhaenyra be put aside. The greatest danger was deemed to be Storm's End, for House Baratheon had always been staunch in support of the claims of Princess Rhaenys and her children. Though old Lord Boromund had died, his son Boros was even more belligerent than his father, and the lesser Storm Lords would surely follow wherever he led. "Then we must see that he leads them to our king," Queen Alicent declared, whereupon she sent for her second son. Thus it was not a raven who took flight for Storm's End that day, but Vhagar, oldest and largest of the dragons of Westeros. On her back rode Prince Aemond Targaryen, with a sapphire in the place of his missing eye. "Your purpose is to win the hand of one of Lord Baratheon's daughters," his grandsire Ser Otto told him before he flew. "Any of the four will do. Woo her and wed her, and Lord Boros will deliver the Stormlands for your brother. Fail?"
"I will not fail," Prince Aemond blustered. "Aegon will have Storm's End, and I will have this girl."
By the time Prince Aemond took his leave, the stink from the dead king's bedchamber had wafted all through Maegor's holdfast, and many wild tales and rumours were spreading through the court and castle. The dungeons under the Red Keep had swallowed up so many men suspected of disloyalty that even the High Septon had begun to wonder at these disappearances, and sent word from the Starry Sept of Old Town asking after some of the missing. Sir Otto Hightower, as methodical a man as ever served as hand, wanted more time to make preparations, but Queen Alicent knew they could delay no longer. Prince Aegon had grown weary of secrecy.
"Am I a king or no?" he demanded of his mother. "If I am king, then crown me."
The bells began to ring on the 10th day of the 3rd moon of 129 AC, tolling the end of a reign. Grand Maester Orwell was at last allowed to send forth his ravens, and the black birds took to the air by the hundreds, spreading the word of Aegon's ascension to every far corner of the realm. The Silent Sisters were sent for to prepare the corpse for burning, and riders went forth on pale horses to spread the word to the people of King's Landing, crying, "King Viserys is dead! Long live King Aegon!" Hearing the cries, Munken writes, some wept, whilst others cheered, but most of the small folk stared in silence, confused and wary. And now and again a voice cried out, "Long live our queen!" Meanwhile, hurried preparations were made for the coronation. The Dragon Pit was chosen as the site. Under its mighty dome were stone benches, sufficient to seat 80,000, and the pit's thick walls, strong roof, and towering bronze doors made it defensible, should traitors attempt to disrupt the ceremony. On the appointed day, Sacristan Cole placed the iron and ruby crown of Aegon the Conqueror upon the brow of the eldest son of King Viserys and Queen Alicent, proclaiming him Aegon of House Targaryen, second of his name, King of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm. His mother, Queen Alicent, beloved of the small folk, placed her own crown upon the head of her daughter Helena, Aegon's wife and sister. After kissing her cheeks, the mother knelt before the daughter, bowed her head, and said, "My queen." How many came to see the crowning remains a matter of dispute. Grand Maester Munken, drawing upon Orwell, tells us that more than 100,000 small folk jammed into the Dragon Pit, their cheers so loud they shook the very walls, whilst Mushroom says the stone benches were half-filled. With the High Septon in Old Town, too old and frail to journey to King's Landing, it fell to Septon Eustace to anoint King Aegon's brow with holy oils, and bless him in the seven names of God. A few of those in attendance, with sharper eyes than most, might have noticed that there were but four white cloaks in attendance on the new king, not five as heretofore. Aegon II had suffered his first defections the night before, when Sir Stephen Darklyn of the King's Guard had slipped from the city with his squire, two stewards, and four guardsmen. Under the cover of darkness they made their way out of Postern Gate to where a fisherman's skiff awaited to take them to Dragonstone. They brought with them a stolen crown,
a band of yellow gold ornamented with 7 gems of different colours. This was the crown King Viserys had worn, and the old King Jaehaerys before him. When Prince Aegon had decided to wear the iron and ruby crown of his namesake, the Conqueror, Queen Alicent had ordered Viserys's crown locked away, but the steward entrusted with the task had made off with it instead. After the coronation, the remaining King's Guard escorted Aegon to his mount, a splendid creature with gleaming golden scales and pale pink wing membranes. Sunfire was the name given this dragon of the Golden Dawn. Vancan tells us the king flew thrice around the city before landing inside the walls of the Red Keep. Sir Eric Cargill led his grace into the torchlit throne room, where Aegon II mounted the steps of the Iron Throne before 1,000 lords and knights. Shouts rang through the hall. On Dragonstone, no cheers were heard. Instead, screams echoed through the halls and stairwells of Sea Dragon Tower, down from the Queen's apartments where Rhaenyra Targaryen strained and shuddered in her third day of labour. The child had not been due for another turn of the moon, but the tidings from King's Landing had driven the princess into a black fury, and her rage seemed to bring on the birth, as if the babe inside her were angry too and fighting to get out. The princess shrieked curses all through her labour, calling down the wrath of the gods upon her half-brothers and their mother, the queen, and detailing the torments she would inflict upon them before she would let them die. She cursed the child inside her, too, Mushroom tells us, clawing at her swollen belly as Maester Gerardus and her midwife tried to restrain her, and shouting, "Monster! Monster! Get out! Get out! Get out!" When the babe at last came forth, she proved indeed a monster, a stillborn girl, twisted and malformed, with a hole in her chest where her heart should have been, and a stubby, scaled tail. Also Mushroom describes her. The dwarf tells us that it was he who carried the little thing to the yard for burning. The dead girl had been named Visenya, Princess Rhaenyra announced the next day, when milk of the poppy had blunted the edge of her pain. "She was my only daughter, and they killed her. They stole my crown and murdered my daughter, and they shall answer for it." And so the dance began, as the princess called a council of her own, the Black Council, the true-telling names that gathering on Dragonstone, setting it against the Green Council of King's Landing. Rhaenyra herself presided, seated between her uncle and husband, Prince Daemon, and her trusted counsellor, Maester Gerardus. Her 3 sons were present with them, though none had reached the age of manhood. Jace was 14, Luke 13, Joffrey 11. 2 Kingsguard stood with them, Sir Eric Cargill, twin to Sir Eric, and the Westerman, Sir Lawrence Marbrand. 30 knights, 100 crossbowmen, and 300 men-at-arms made up the rest of Dragonstone's garrison. That had always been deemed sufficient for a fortress of such strength. As an instrument of conquest, however, our army leaves something to be desired, Prince Daemon observed sourly. 12 lesser lords, bannermen and vassals to Dragonstone, sat at the Black Council as well. Celtigar of Claw Isle, Staunton of Rook's Rest, Massey of Stone Dance, Bar-Emon of Sharp Point, and Darklyn of Duskendale amongst them. But the greatest lord to pledge his strength to the princess was Corlys Velaryon of Driftmark. Though the sea snake had grown old, he liked to say that he was clinging to life like a drowning sailor clinging to the wreckage of a sunken ship. Mayhaps the 7 have preserved me for this one last fight. With Lord Corlys came his wife, Princess Rhaenys, 55, her face lean and lined, her black hair streaked with white, yet fierce and fearless as she had been at 22. "The queen who never was," Mushroom calls her. What did Viserys ever have that she did not? A little sausage? Is that all it takes to be a king? Let Mushroom rule, then. My sausage is thrice the size of his. Those who sat at the Black Council counted themselves loyalists, but knew full well that King Aegon II would name them traitors. Each had already received a summons from King's Landing, demanding they present themselves at the Red Keep to swear oaths of loyalty to the new king. All their hosts combined could not match the power the high towers alone could field. Aegon's Greens enjoyed other advantages as well. Old Town, King's Landing, and Lannisport were the largest and richest cities in the realm. All three were held by Greens. Every visible symbol of legitimacy belonged to Aegon. He sat the Iron Throne. He lived in the Red Keep.